another edition of the Columbia University Sports Podcast, The Cusp Show. I'm Joe Favorito, along with Tom Richardson. Welcome back, Tom.
Hey, Joe. What's up?
How are you? So we're going to do a little trivia to get started. Some of the baseball players who've played in MLB who've come from Columbia, can you name two, maybe?
Can I name two?
Sure.
Well, I've got one sitting next to me, but I'm not going to reveal his name yet. Right. But no, I can't name another.
Well, arguably the first one would be Lou Gehrig.
Sorry. Very embarrassing.
The Iron Horse. Yes. That is embarrassing, but we'll start there. Who played, obviously.
Maybe we should start over.
You want to start over?
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. So arguably the first one would be Lou Gehrig.
Okay.
And probably the most recent one is also a world champion, Fernando Perez, is that who it would be?
An American League champion.
American League champion.
I wish I could say world champion.
You were close.
Because Fernando played for the Tampa Bay Rays under Joe Maddon and did not win the World Series, but that was part of probably his biggest run in Major League Baseball. And Fernando, a Columbia graduate, played baseball here at Columbia, from New York, now working in the media field, is our guest today. Welcome, Fernando.
Thank you.
Really good to have you here.
Thanks.
This is going to be fun.
So the most important question when we start off is, how did you get here? So Columbia, and we had talked back and forth, you didn't really come to Columbia first to be a baseball player. You really came here because of the writing program, correct?
I did. I thought that I could do the journalism program, and
ooh,
I was wrong. Mm-hmm. And I found out when I got here.
Wow.
But
you applied into undergrad? I mean, undergrad
liberal
arts?
No, I thought that there was a journalism program for undergrads, and I was wrong. But lucky for me, there are lots of other things to study. I studied American studies, and I did the writing program. Really, really loved the writing program, and American studies was right up my alley because it is deeply multidisciplinary, and I was able to study a lot of things, everything from jazz to gender studies, everything. And I had a really good time with it. I was encouraged more by my coach to look at baseball as a serious career option. And I thought that he was lying, really. I thought that he was just sort of saying this because it's the right thing to say. And so I think that the first thing I had to do was sort of convince myself. And then once that happened, I mean, I was stretched really, really thin between trying to take advantage of the city, which is the reason that I really came, between learning how to play the game and between, you know, actually doing school. So
and taking the core, right? So
taking the core
is notoriously challenging for freshmen, right?
Especially if you might want to change the core. And it was a lot.
So you were doing fall workouts, winter workouts, the whole routine?
Absolutely. Yeah. When you have when you've got nothing but the blue gym here, you have to sometimes show up in that blue gym at 5 a.m. so that you have 3 hours with your team. And you might be on half of the court playing baseball with rubber baseballs, which is a real thing that really happened in my life. And then, you know, you might be trying to get some extra swings in because you're probably going to be drafted that year. And the badminton PE squad might come in and kick you out because it's important for some of your classmates who you know are drunk to do their PE. So it's interesting. It's very democratic and fair, but it's definitely very, very difficult, with the facilities.
But at what point did the coach actually tap you and say, I think you can be bigger than a college experience? I think you can actually make it to the bigs.
My freshman year, I would say in between my freshman year and my sophomore year, he sent me to the Great Lakes Summer Collegiate League, which is probably the third best league in the country after Alaska and the Cape. And, he said it to me very plainly. I remember sort of, you know, thinking that I think he's just trying to, like, get me to play better or something. I wasn't really taking it seriously. I think that is just, as I tell people, I think it's just Northeastern sensibility. That's maybe, in the Northeast, we're kind of cautious with that. We're very, realistic. And I definitely didn't look at playing, you know, being a professional athlete is a realistic thing. Funny thing is, when I talked to a lot of people here, they didn't take it very seriously either. I mean, when I told my mom that I was going to sign after my junior year, she said, no, you're going to finish school is what you're going to do. This, there's no team going to give you money to play baseball. This is crazy. And, you know, a good friend of mine, I told him over lunch in Lerner Hall, I said, I think I'm going to probably get drafted. And he thought, you know, that I was, you know, obviously making this up just on some flight of fancy.
So you go and you start playing in the minors and work your way up the Rays and eventually get to the major leagues with the Rays. What was kind of like the life on the road? Is it the typical minor league stories that you always hear? Was it different for you? And then how did you adapt that to kind of where you were going?
The experience of being a minor leaguer is that you see a lot of mid-sized American cities that most people will never see. There's not really an explicit reason to visit a lot of these places, and that's actually what I loved about it the most.
What were some of those cities?
So the first year I was in Battle Creek, Michigan.
It's played the home of Kellogg's, isn't it?
Yes,
Kellogg's. Yeah. Absolutely, and the smell of Kellogg's factory looms over the stadium, and we played that year in front of either 15 fans. Or on Saturdays, we played in front of 4,000 screaming children that were not even watching the game. But Battle Creek was really interesting. So I started off the year really bad, was kind of thinking in my head, I'm like, oh, I think maybe I'm hitting my ceiling here. These are, you know, you get to a spring training and you're introduced to 150 guys who are the best players from their town. Like the guy, like, oh, I set the record for home runs in Texas. Oh, I did this. I played on Team USA. And everybody's sort of feeling each other out, and guys are at different levels. There's some guys that are really, really confident, and little do they know they've actually reached the peak of their development. And then there are guys like myself that really have no idea that they will have an opportunity to rise to the
right,
level of the
competition. Right, because statistically, isn't it a very small single-digit percentage that makes it past the minors?
They say that it's about 4%. Yeah. So I went from Battle Creek, then the very next year I went to the California League. I was playing for the Visalia Oaks.
Wow.
In the San Joaquin Valley. The California League is really interesting. There's a lot of offense in that league. That was one of the most fun times I've ever had in my life. I led the minor leagues in runs scored. I was just running around the bases all year long because we had a football team for an offense. It was really, really fun. And then Double A, then I got a chance to play for the marquee minor league franchises. I got a chance to be a Montgomery Biscuit. And then I went on to the Durham Bulls. And,
wow.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So
you must have some good old uniforms in your closet.
Oh, you don't get to keep them. It's minor league baseball. Okay. Don't think you get to keep them. Okay. They are.
Your hats, you know, at least?
Oh, the hats, yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah, the hats you keep. That's something that I really, really loved, is just getting a sense of what Middle America was like, what the South was like, what, you know, California that is not the sexy California of postcards is like. I really, really loved that. It was, like I said, like a direct connection to American studies. And I wrote quite a bit in that time, but what was the most exciting about it was that I was just doing writing that I wanted to do. I wasn't writing for anyone because I had a really great job and I didn't really want to change anything. I studied poetry here at Columbia, and so it wasn't as if, it's not exactly a job that, you know, makes you tons of money, so it was sort of perfect.
Did any media come up to you? I mean, were you a regular media target of, oh, I got to go talk to the Hispanic guy from Columbia because that's kind of the interesting story when the team comes to town?
Absolutely, and that is good and bad. I would say mostly bad. A lot of people that I played with and a lot of people involved with baseball, there was this idea that I was just, I think they were a little upset. They thought that an Ivy League person was supposed to be like different. There's definitely a lot of, you know, a lot of folks coming up to me and saying like, do you know like this about molecular biology? I'd say, actually, I don't. Yeah, and it's right. Like, well, what good are you for, really? Right. So there's, you know, that. And that I'm joking, but there are actually a lot of serious ways in which that was
somewhat annoying. But you did say that, 'cause the majority of the players have... Did most of the players not have college educations?
I would say most of them, because even the ones that didn't really have to go to class.
Right.
I think that it's definitely an advantage if you think about going to, say, Arizona State. I know friends that, you know, went to Arizona State. I think that there, that's much more of like, probably what it would be like to go to Bolotari or something like that and be a baseball, you know, prodigy. You do some class when it's convenient, but you're never in situations where, you know, I have to run in it because of facilities. I have to run in the gym until our like more obese players throw up. and that's from probably 6 to 7. And then I have to have breakfast, get to class at 9. I have to stay awake during class. I have to then go do probably an individual workout in the gym. Then I go to another class. Then I have to go take the subway all the way up to practice. Then I got to come back, go to a night class, all of those things. Well, when you have facilities, and then when you also have, you know, lenience from your professors because they really, really respect that specific, you know, institution and all of the demands of it, it's just a lot easier. You know, I'm not sure when I look back and to say, you know, would I do it differently? Maybe. I think that it's, you know, I loved this place. I really, really loved this place. But it has become increasingly difficult, I believe, to be a student athlete in places like this.
And when you hit the Rays, you were about to get called up, so you were AAA. That was not really, that was just becoming the Rays that people know today, which are uber successful.
Oh,
Joe
yeah.
Maddon was just getting started. People didn't know Evan Longoria at that point. So you were really kind of hitting it just as Stu Sternberg's team was becoming what they are today, which is a contender almost every year.
Everything was changing very, very fast. I was drafted by the Devil Rays. We wore Kelly Green. Things were grim. You know, you knew the big league team was going to be bad, which actually was sort of exciting for a good, actually very, very good minor league core, where there was just opportunity. But, you know, guys were going up and, you know, mostly getting destroyed. But you had some players that, you know, really kept them respectable. I mean, in the years that Carl Crawford had before he moved on, I mean, his numbers rival Pete Rose's numbers in those years, which, you know, people forget. You know, Scott Kazmir, that's when he was just throwing 97 and letting people try to hit it, you know. So there's a lot of things leading up to the big change. I think that Andrew Friedman is brilliant and Stu is brilliant, but one thing that will help you be successful very, very quickly is being terrible for many, many years and stocking all of those picks. And if you look at the team that the Rays put together, you're talking 8 or so, almost once in a lifetime picks, and
some good trades that they
and yeah, there. And a few good trades. And so I you're exactly right. I arrived when things were getting really, really exciting. I was putting together a pretty good year, and it seemed like it was going to happen. But even when it did happen, there's still this, you know, you can't believe it's happening. But then, you know, you're in the middle of a pennant race as soon as you get called up. So my first at bat was in the Rogers Center, which is just a monstrosity of a place. It's just enormous.
This is in Toronto.
In Toronto. And so one of the first things that you have to get used to, you know, it really is the same game. A major league game might be a double-A game. I mean, those guys throw the ball all over the place as well, but there are little things that you have to prepare for. Two very specific that I can talk about. The first is that your adrenaline is such that you feel, you know, you feel like you've had 10 cups of coffee and you cannot control your body. So you've been training your whole life since you've become a professional to cut down your swing and to sort of take everything slowly. And then you're thrust onto the field in these important times and you cannot calm down. It's impossible. You cannot cut down your swing. You cannot, you know, throw it nice and easy. You have to relearn to play the game again. It's amazing.
And it's all psychological.
And it's all psychological.
Right.
And then the other thing is that visually, you're now in these enormous cathedrals. And so, you know, just chasing a fly ball is a very, very different experience when there are stands and so many people. You can, in a big league stadium, you can run 100 feet and feel like you didn't go anywhere. So, and then you have to, you know, get used to the ballparks, new players. Everything is just happening really, really, really fast. So all of that was happening in the midst of a pennant race. You know, I got a hit in my very, very first at bat. I did a sneaky push bunt off of BJ Ryan in the Rogers Center, and then I went promptly 0 for my next 9 and figured that I would never play ever again. And then we were playing in Fenway Park, which ended up being the first game. The Rays and the Red Sox were you know, tit for tat, first and second all year. And this was the very first series that the away team had won. Every team is pretty interesting. Every home game was won by the home team. And there's a guy, Dan Johnson, who is one of the most clutch sort of unknown players that you will ever hear of. Dan Johnson had another great year for our AAA team. And the day before this game, Dan Johnson was called up, and he arrived at the stadium around 6 or so. So Joe had told me that I would be, you know, pinch hitting for someone. I told BJ Upton that Dan Johnson is about to tie the game with a home run. Dan Johnson hits a home run off of Jonathan Papelbon. And I came up, you know, and I hit a double off of Jonathan Papelbon, which I'm assuming when you look back at those things, if I don't get a hit there, I don't know if I ever play again. I mean, I was 0 for 10, so those things are important. You know, Joe was amazing. The thing that he's really, really good at and why the Cubs went and got him is because he really makes his players very, very comfortable to play. Really, really gives you this sense of feeling very, very comfortable and really lets you be yourself. But, you know, he's fair. And, you know, as he told me one spring training that he cut me, he said, really want to have you on this team. You're just not good enough as a hitter from the left side. And so, you know, he could have said the same thing to me and said, you know, I want to get you in this game, but, you know, if you're going to hit 100, I'm just going to put one of these veterans that's going to hit 100 in. So, yeah, it was a really, really, really blessed year. I ended up making the postseason roster and asked Joe and Davey Martinez whether they were really bringing me to each consecutive series. You know, am I really on the ALCS roster? Am I really on the World Series roster? Things worked well.
They finally said, you stop asking. You
actually
made it.
That is exactly what happened around the ALCS. There's like, yes, we actually need you. Stop being annoying.
Can I ask you this? Because in baseball, and you played other sports, you mentioned in baseball, it appears to be less of a team dynamic in terms of the coming together and the psychology. Mm-hmm. So when you come up as a rookie, do they try to embrace you as a teammate, or are you just seen as something to fill a gap?
It's you're exactly right. It's both, and it depends on the team, and it depends on the situation. I think that if you've got a veteran team and you have a rookie that comes up and these games don't matter, the veterans they feel an onus to sort of put that rookie through the ringer.
Right.
You know, right now, if you look at the whole situation that happened with was with Brett Laurie and the catcher, actually, that we used to have, a guy that I played with. But, you know, there was the whole thing about hazing, and mm-hmm. this guy was saying, you know, you can't let these rookies run amok and la da da da. There is a lot of that in baseball, sort of this like, you know, rookie training program that I think is a little bit more excessive than other sports. Every sport does something, you know. They cut Tebow's head to make him look like a saint. They do that in all sports, but baseball in a lot of ways has a little bit of a more involved process. I think that in baseball there's more of a clear sense of what a baseball player is supposed to be, supposed to look like, supposed to act like. And the veterans really, really, they really, really exert their influence to try to make that happen. Now, that team was very, very young, and because of Joe, it was very, very different. So I felt very, very comfortable from the beginning, but then again, I understood what the script was. I think that some guys, they get there, and it's, you know, a generational thing. I think a lot of people try to pin a lot of sort of negative things on, you know, the younger generations. I would assume that's been happening for all of time. But, you know, I definitely saw a script. I saw, all right, these people are in charge. These are the things that please them. Let's just do these things. If you want me to, you know, cut your chicken into little bites and deliver you beer on the, you know, on the plane because that makes you feel good, I'm going to do that because it's very, very easy. But it's certainly problematic and gets much more problematic on other teams. And the stuff that you're saying about chemistry, we don't really know whether it is chemistry that makes the winning or winning that makes the chemistry. Mm. When the whole team is close, despite not having a good record, I've never seen it yet. So that's a really, really good question that I think that it's very, very difficult to answer. But you know, baseball isn't really a team sport. It's an individual sport that is framed with a team concept. And so if you have 20 guys that are having great years, you have team chemistry because everyone's happy, you know. A losing team in a lot of ways is a collection of players that are having individually losing seasons. There aren't that many.
Which means their jobs are in jeopardy.
Means their jobs are in jeopardy. There aren't that many efforts that involve teamwork in baseball.
Right.
Turning a double play, the battery, sure. But there's not that much teamwork. Everybody's just doing their, you know, their own thing. But there's this, we have this sort of training. It's like a default. You know, we like, oh, that was a great team win. Well, was it really a team win, or did many of the players on the team do well in that win? You know,
are you a fan of analytics?
I am. I definitely. I'm definitely.
Was it starting to
get
popular when you were still playing, or was it?
It was with them. It's definitely very interesting when you have guys that hate it, and then you have guys that love it. There are a lot of guys that hate it in baseball, and you know, that play for teams because it's threatening to them. You know, if a computer algorithm is saying that you should be on the bench, you know, of course you're going to say, well, what does this computer know? Like, maybe the computer knows. You know, it doesn't always know. But I'm really, really a fan of them. There are just obvious holes in them that have to be considered. It's definitely very, very interesting. I think that it's a little bit too wedded to fantasy, probably. And then there are just simple things that I would say sully the numbers. A lot of if you just think about shadows in baseball and how much they play a role in hitting, that is something right there that is not in the statistics. That is the influence of the shadows on the at bat is something that affects the entire, you know, data set. Steroids, something that affects the entire data set. So, you know, a lot of it you take with a grain of salt, but some things when you know, focused very specifically are really, really compelling for sure.
And we just want to remind everyone, this is the Columbia University Sports Podcast. I'm Joe Favorito along with my co-host Tom Richardson. Our guest is Fernando Perez. Major League Baseball player, Columbia graduate, and now media member. And that's kind of what we want to move into next, Tom, is kind of you finish your career, you have an injury, you go on, you play another couple of years, and you get to the end. How do you get to where you are now, which is doing things on the opposite side in the media, but for places like Vice or the New York Times Magazine?
You learn to be used to failure in baseball, and that should help you. Don't know if it helps or not, because it still hurts when you are sending, you know, notes out, hey, I am me, I exist, I am useful, am I of use to you? And you get emails back. I mean, you get emails back if you're lucky.
I was going to say, if you get an email back.
If you get an email back. So the media thing, you know, having the opportunity to write about baseball is something that's available to a lot of players. Any athlete is, because of their experience playing the sport, is far too down to earth in this sense to talk about teams and players in the way that is sort of becoming popular. There's this, you know, this guy sucks and this guy sucks and this guy sucks. Well, actually, this guy is the 300th best person in a thing in the world.
Right.
So he doesn't suck actually at all. He is perhaps in relation to some of the other better humans at this thing, he is maybe not as good at, you know, as them. So there are certain tones that I definitely don't take that I think that we have a taste for, and a lot of that is fantasy based, but a lot of the other stuff is not so much related to baseball. It's just being interested in stories and sort of seeing the media trends right now. We are something that is great that's happening is a lot of writing forms are sort of being taken over in video form. So something that I've been doing are basically video profiles. I could meet you guys and write a profile on you, or I could spend the day with you and continue to interview you and sort of pull off a profile like that. So I have a column for Vice, a baseball column, and it's really fun. I can tell him that I want him to draw Wade Davis on a bottle of hot sauce, and he will do it. He did this gorgeous drawing of the column that I did last week was about baseball's unwritten etiquette rules, touching upon Goose Gossage and him yelling at clouds wherever he is. And he drew this gorgeous illustration of Babe Ruth with a sort of a take on a Donald Trump hat on in front of a flag. It was really gorgeous. But essentially the thesis of that was, we're talking about all of this, these etiquette gaffes. We're talking about guys flipping their bats and, you know, playing with emotion and being fun and derisive. And I wanted to remind people that the person, the God, the undisputed God of baseball is Babe Ruth in lots of respects. And his legacy is not at all tainted by any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. He was the first, you know, swagged out baseball player whose antics, you know, rehashed a century later by some people are driving people insane. And so the Vice column is really fun. They give me a lot of room to just sort of write whatever I want. The other stuff with Vice is they have their new TV network coming out. I'm hosting a show called Rivals, which is about the most interesting sports rivalries across the world. So I was actually part of one of the only domestic shoots. They've got stories in Senegal. They've got stories in Serbia. It is really, really, really interesting. I've seen about half of them, and they are really, really good.
So that will be a special on Viceland.
Yeah, that'll be a show on Viceland.
Do you know when it's going to air?
I don't know when it'll air yet, but I will, you know, I'll share that as soon as possible. It should be sometime in May. They have Viceland has two offerings. They have Vice World of Sports, and then they have Rivals, which is specifically about rivalries. There are some season two shoots that they've you know asked me to do that are really, really fascinating that I can't talk about, but they are as exciting as the rest of the stuff that we're doing.
And you've got some other things coming with MLB Network and MLB.com that kind of give your unique spin on the game of baseball, which is kind of how you got here, correct?
Yeah, I mean, my big thing is I just really want to stay close. I'm not super interested in working for a team because when it comes down to it, my allegiance is to the game, to the growth of the game, to the game being much more inclusive than it has been. Not so much with making one team, you know, better than all of the other teams. It's once you've, you know, done that on the inside, there are a lot of guys that go from playing to, you know, working for a club, but not so much for me at this point in my life. I just want to stay around the game. And so if I'm able to do that, however, is great.
Talk about that for a second. What do you mean by inclusiveness in that context?
Well, you know, one thing that we're seeing, obviously, baseball is about a third Latino now. Your experience going to a ballpark is still kind of post-colonial and boring. There hasn't been a corresponding shift in leadership, in the league, in teams.
Front offices and management.
There's a problem there. And so, you know, Mr. Manfred had some things to say about that, which he said that things were cyclical because of the idea that it's a revolving door for managers and stuff. And that's definitely true, but, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, there were about 10 managers of color, and, you know, we've got maybe one now. Latin players are not having the greatest time. You don't know that because they're very, very well trained to not let that on. So there are little things here and there that can be done. You know, I was actually at the commissioner's office talking to them a lot about this, about implementing a program for translators. So the translator thing comes out, and already there's blowback from certain teams saying, we don't think that this is viable. We don't like this. So that's problematic. If you, as a person, are interested in consuming Latin players playing the game, you should be interested in consuming the Latin culture that comes with them. You will not have a seizure if you listen to somebody speak Spanish. You won't. And, in fact, you should. 'Cause, again, we stole this country from Indians, and none of us speak any Native American. So when it comes to the labor relations between Latin players and the league, I just think that it would be in everyone's best interest to see more Latin culture taking the place of what, you know, the best baseball player in our game called a tired culture. That's problematic. LeBron James has not come out and said, "Ugh, the NBA, it's just so tired." That never happened. Yeah. Tom Brady didn't come out and say, "Ugh, the NFL, it's so tired." Bryce Harper came out and said, "This is a tired culture." And there are lots of reasons to point. There are lots of, you know, barometers to sort of, you know, make that conclusion. If you saw the brilliant HBO Real Sports thing that Chris Rock did, some of the numbers are staggering.
That's terrific.
It's amazing, and some of the numbers are staggering. There is a legitimate concern that once these guys, this, you know, mostly white men of the greatest generation, once they're gone, who's going to like baseball? Because the kids right now, they are interested in other sports. So some things need to happen. I think that it's very, very easy for the league to be complacent when you're making $10 billion still. So, you know, it's a lot of the baseball culture stuff. It comes off a little bit alarmist since, you know, business is booming and things are great, great, great. Nobody really knows what things will be like when, like I said, in 20 years, will baseball be small again? Will the MLS is taking off in a really, really serious way. I've worked for Major League Baseball. They have their programs internationally. I've worked as a coach in Europe and in Africa recently this year. And baseball has some challenges traveling across the pond. Just logistically, it's far more difficult for for Major League Baseball to do what the NBA has done in the same amount of time. It's very, very easy to go to the middle of Angola and put a basketball, you know, hoop up, or a gym. It's very, very difficult to put up a baseball stadium, have the equipment, teach people how to play, and field a team. It's difficult to practice baseball if you're a professional player. It's one of the only sports that's, in a sense, impossible to actually practice, you know? And so there are a lot of challenges for the game growing. I think that many people who really, really love baseball would like to see them get going with a little bit more haste.
So I know Major League Baseball has a diversity and inclusion office, and they seem to take it quite seriously. Are you suggesting that it's not really translating to the club level in terms of the hiring practices and the way they view all that?
Yeah, because those are private entities, you know, and that was sort of one of the takeaways. One of the takeaways when you go to the office is you realize that there are 8 offices within the office and that communication between them is not so great. And again, you know, there's this sort of, we're making billions of dollars. Like, what are we going to change? Why are we going to change things? We're doing great. So you're exactly right. I mean, even something like fan experience, that has to happen at the team level,
right?
You know,
where the rubber hits the road.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of things. There are so many different power structures to navigate. The players' union is obviously the strongest union in the country, and then you have the individual teams. They can do whatever it is that they want, and then you have the league that has some influence, but doesn't have that much influence because the union is in a lot of ways as strong as the league. So it is very, very difficult for things to change. And a lot of that is because there is an internal culture, I think, really, really content to navel gaze at its own past. The past is terrifying to most people, actually. And so, if you think about a stadium experience, part of baseball's allure from, you know, the wood, the leather, is this sort of nostalgic experience, making, you know, when you go to the stadiums feeling like this was just like this 100 years
right.
ago. And I think that consideration tends to bleed into items of culture and things that are actually inappropriate and destructive when you look at the long-term goal of the league. The language barrier is an issue for people. As we said, there are people that are made uncomfortable when people are speaking Spanish, and there is a double standard for sure at play in sports, and I can describe it by the following. If a scientist came in here who was nominated for a Nobel Prize and they were from Albania, you would not for a moment attribute their struggle with the language to mean that they are in any way inferior. That is not what's at play in baseball with Latin folks. And that is something that I am very, very passionate about, a truth that I think that I can speak to. So
literally, because you are bilingual, correct?
Yeah, and I've seen it. So what's problematic to me is that, you know, baseball, it could not be any more clear that baseball is a physical language. You're not a stronger baseball practitioner if you speak perfect English. It's a physical language. For me, a sad truth from my experience of playing baseball, it felt as though many people felt that Latin players could play the game, but they couldn't teach the game or administrate the game. That is untrue. Ozzie Guillen had his troubles, and Ozzie Guillen's English is great, you know? But again, I mean, let's look at what happened to Ozzie Guillen. Ozzie Guillen won a World Series, and Ozzie Guillen can't find a job, you know?
One other question we had, not to get off topic, but you talked about well-read and kind of thinking out of the box. Where do you normally go for your information? Who do you follow, not just in sports, but as a media member, as someone who's interested in literacy, as a journalist? You know, who do you follow? Who would you recommend people follow?
And who are your go-to poets? That's what I want to know.
I mean, I'm somebody that I read basically every dispatch from Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic. On the poetry side, I realize that I'm a little bit, I'm like out of the game, you know? So it would be as if I told you, like, oh yeah, you know, like I'm really into Ken Griffey Jr. He's one of my favorite players. I'm a little bit behind, so I have to kind of like brush up, but my favorite poet had always been, John Ashbery, because I loved how much people hated him. I thought it was so fascinating. And my favorite thing that he's ever said is he was interviewed by the PBS fellow, not Charlie Rose, a different one. And they asked him, why do you do this? You know, when did you decide to write poetry? And he said that he picked up a poetry book and he said, oh, I can do that. And that's why he's doing
really?
What
he's
doing.
These aren't that long.
That's why he's doing what he's doing. But on the sports side, there are a lot of really interesting outlets right now that are doing a lot of interesting things. You know, ESPN, the magazine, is always doing really, really interesting things. I'm actually a firm believer in the mission of the Players Tribune. I think that I would love to see them. I was talking with folks there yesterday in developing a story, and I would love to. What I said is that I would love to see them, you know, basically get a little bit closer. And what they said is that, you know, those are challenges that are a little bit out of their hands, because a lot of the times.
What do you mean by that when you say getting closer?
So when I say getting closer, you know, some of the stories that we're seeing, there's definitely a place for stories that are, you know, on the fluffier side. There's a place for that because those are real emotions, you know. So when I say that I'd like to see them get closer, I think that there are a lot more athletes that have a lot more to say. But the struggle that they're having is that they're dealing a lot of the times with agents and
intermediaries,
intermediaries, yeah. And you know, they're also dealing with the circumstance that players are understanding that it is almost more worthwhile to just say nothing and praise God. And so I think what's happening with them, where they're you know, stalling out, let's say, is that they're realizing that there is a sort of a culture that dissuades players from being open and from, you know, giving us what we really want. I did an interview with, you know, Chris Archer is one of my, you know, favorite players that's playing right now. I did an interview with him last year on Sports on Earth, and, you know, 75% of that interview, what we could not go forward with. And I didn't even ask him. I knew where the line was because I've played baseball before. I knew where the line was. I didn't even ask him. I knew that for him, it's safer for him, and he'll have safer passage, especially in baseball, which is by far the most conservative of all sports, where you, you know, you will never see a tweet or a retweet about anything having to do with Black Lives Matter, yet it is totally okay to, you know, pull a Luke Scott and openly talk about the president not being an American, and worse. So, you know, baseball is the most conservative lane that there is in sports, and I could intuit with Archer the line that it was, you know, not really good for him to go across.
Are you a fan of the notable players, some of the big personalities establishing kind of a real strong position in social media? When I say position, just having kind of a real presence and actually taking that risk, because obviously they're subject to lots of criticism. They're subject to a lot of trolls, trolling, I should say. And then you get a situation like now, you might have heard about Steph Curry's new initiative with his college roommate. They're doing this thing called Slice, mm-hmm. which is a kind of a more filtered social media platform, which they intend to use in lieu of Twitter, for example, or maybe in mm-hmm. addition to, but in a way to make it a little bit more manageable for both sides of the equation, not turn into this big free-for-all that a lot of social media has become.
It's really, really difficult to make that decision. Even when, you know, I'm working on a story right now for New York Times Magazine, and I'm certain that I will get hate mail for a year for it. You have to be you have to understand what you're getting into. My girlfriend writes about social issues and gets hate mail and death threats monthly. And so it's something that you have to understand what you're getting into. And so while you may spend some time, if you are somebody that's connected to social issues and you are interested in the rights that you may have for everyone, you have to realize that you're getting yourself into something that, you know, you can't really reverse. So while you're looking at some of these people saying, like, I wish Tiger Woods would just stand for something, you know, on the other side, he looks at it like, you know, I don't want to do that. And you can't really blame them because of the climate, right. You know? Right. And so you actually have to be, maybe now with the internet, you know, I wouldn't know, I'm too young, but you maybe have to be braver than you ever had to have been to stand up for issues.
So one last question off of that, and you talked about Chris Archer. As a player, would you have taken the stand that you're taking now, or you talked about cutting the meat and doing the other things just to get to that point? If you would have taken that stand then, could you be where you are now to do what it is that you want to do?
They asked me if I wanted to validate my Twitter, thereby gaining 30,000 followers. I said no, because all I can see is trouble.
Wow.
And that's, you know, that's the truth. And I wasn't gonna be that person that was gonna, like, get on Twitter and, you know, be like drunk at 2 a.m. That wasn't what I was going to do. I was just probably going to make a matter of fact point about social justice that is entirely normal in New York and just blasphemous in baseball, mm-hmm. and it would be problematic for me. Another, you know, interesting aspect of baseball is you are regularly at the mercy of people you are competing against for your safety. You know, I would have to go and hit against a pitcher who might not have liked my comments last week. So
I didn't even think about that.
There's another element to it. I think that, you know, in my last Vice column, when I was trying to write about the unwritten etiquette rules, that was, to me, the only thing missing in that talk about baseball is the fact that baseball has an internal justice system, and that internal justice system has a lot of influence over how uniform and homogenous the baseball players are. As a player, you don't want to stick out. You don't want to give the team, you don't want to give a team any reason to think of you as special. That's a theory or a principle that goes across all sports. You don't want to ever give the other team incentive. But specifically, when you're talking about the etiquette stuff, is like, you know, if you watch, you know, videos of me hitting home runs, I hit a home run and I ran around the bases really, really fast, very, very polite, no bat flip. And I didn't do that because I thought that that was aesthetically better. I actually think that bat flips are amazing. And when I watch the, you know, we have to all see where this came from. And it came from Korea, where these guys hit these balls and they do these unbelievable bat flips. And the pitchers, they look at the ball. They don't watch the guy thinking, oh, I don't like the way he flipped that bat.
He's insulting me.
Four revolutions on the bat flip, I'm going to hit you now. Well, over here, right, baseball, we've developed this bizarre sensitivity issue. In basketball, you get dunked on, and a guy is, you know, flexing his muscles, and what do? You inbounds the ball, and you keep playing basketball. And in baseball, what we do is, I've seen a guy, you know, a guy, he struck out the side, I remember in Tampa, and one of our players was like, I think he just kissed his bicep. This guy ran into the clubhouse, into the video room to see if he could get confirmation of whether the guy kissed his bicep. That's how ridiculous we've become in baseball. Why, if I were to guess, it's because we have so much downtime. We have nothing better to do than to look at each other and say, oh, you are sticking out from the mold. That's not what you're supposed to be doing.
How dare you?
Yeah, and I think that the internal justice system drives it. I ran around the bases the way that I did because I knew, A, as a rookie, that it would please the incumbent party of veterans, and also because I was going to be safe the next time. That no pitcher would say, oh, it's that guy that did that. I'm going to hit him now. I was you know, safe in the box.
So as the guy who did that or didn't do that and is not verified, where can people find you on social media or Instagram? Or
where will you allow us?
I'm on Twitter. It is @FernandoPerez3. I'm pretty sure. I'm trying to tweet more, but I will definitely be posting more dispatches from different things that I'm working on as the links become available.
And you've got a byline on Vice. So Vice
You'll find my column there. My Vice column is titled Recovering Ball Player. Mm-hmm. And my season preview will be up probably tomorrow. I just finished it. And then there are, you know, different stories coming up. The other thing that I could plug is that I'll be working with MLB.com on these alternative broadcasts. So if you are one of the millions with that app, you can watch these games and instead tune in to myself and I believe Will Leach, the founding editor of...
So when you say that app, are you talking about MLB.tv?
Yeah, the MLB at bat app. Yeah. We were recently tested for this and recently hired for it, so I don't know all of the details, but as far as I understand, we will be in a studio and giving you a different broadcast, like an alternative broadcast with a lot of stat stuff, a lot of stat-driven stuff, which is really, really cool. We did the tests for it the other day, and we were in a room like this. A lot of guys, you know, your standard talking about baseball, but less of the, like, here's the 2-2 pitch, and more of the, let's have a look at the route he took for that ball, let's look at the movement of this, let's look at his spin rate for this pitch compared to the spin rate from last year. So a lot of advanced statistics stuff.
And just a word to the wise, if you're doing a Cardinals game, don't screw with Will Leach because he is one of the biggest Cardinals fans out there.
All right.
Fernando, thank you for joining us. Once again, I'm Joe Favorito.
And Tom Richardson. And Joe, we should give a special thanks to the City of New York for providing the sound effects.
Yep.
I think we've heard trucks, we've heard buses, we've heard ambulances, and I just heard a radio a few minutes ago. So it was a terrific conversation. Really appreciate those insights. Fascinating stories, and we look forward to seeing you this baseball season on Viceland, on MLB.tv and at Bat, and hopefully in other places soon. But Thanks.
Thanks for
we'll
having me.
See everybody
me.
Next time on The Cusp Show. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Cusp Show. That's the Columbia University Sports Podcast. I'm Tom Richardson. My co-host is Joe Favorito. And our production assistant this week is Columbia student James Appel. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple's podcast app, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and on other key platforms. You can also see it at blogtalkradio.com/The Cusp Show. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter at CU Sports Biz, that's B-I-Z. Also, you can find out more about our program, the Columbia University Sports Management Program, by going online at sps.columbia.edu/sports-management. Thank you.